Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mohammad Sahimi, a professor of chemical engineering and an Iranian native, who expresses concern about the recent assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists and rising tensions with the West that could lead to war. Kevin Gastola, a civil liberties blogger with Fire Dog Lake, who assesses the charges Private First Class Bradley Manning will face in an upcoming court-martial for his alleged leak of government documents to WikiLeaks. And Diedrich Mohammed of the NAACP, who discusses United for a Fair Economy's just-released report on disturbing trends in racial economic disparity, titled State of the Dream 2012, The Emerging Majority. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The government of Myanmar has released several hundred political prisoners, including leaders from the student uprising in 1988 and the monk-led Saffron Revolution of 2007. In response, the Obama administration will send an ambassador to Burma for the first time since 1990. Among the prominent activists released on January 13th was Min Ko Nai, leader of the 88 Generation Student Group and underground student leader of the pro-democracy movement. Following his release from prison in 2004, he was jailed for a second time in 2007 for organizing protests against high fuel prices. Since March, the new military-backed civilian government of President Thein Sein has moved forward with reforms and made steps toward opening up the closed society, including bringing pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi into the political process. A day before the release of 650 prisoners, Myanmar agreed to a ceasefire with ethnic Karen rebels, who have been fighting for their independence for 60 years. Western governments, including the United States and Britain, have long sought peace deals between ethnic insurgencies and the government in Burma as a price for ending sanctions and restoring full diplomatic relations. Myanmar, wedged between China and India, has a wealth of natural resources, including natural gas and timber, that neighboring countries want to exploit. The government is now building a natural gas and an oil pipeline to southwest China. 2 years after a 7.0 magnitude earthquake shattered life in Haiti, more than 500,000 people still live in tent cities. While most of the rubble in the capital city of Port-au-Prince has been cleared away, little housing reconstruction has occurred as international humanitarian groups missed opportunities to build new housing for the displaced. According to the Chronicle of Philanthropy, less than 12,000 homes were repaired in the last 2 years, and only 3,200 new homes were built. Several large housing project plans fell apart due to bureaucratic red tape, political infighting, and land disputes. However, several smaller projects in rural Haiti, linking new housing to agricultural projects, have met with success. Now, several U.S.-based housing groups working in Haiti, including Habitat for Humanity and Food for the Poor, have run out of money, while larger aid groups like the Red Cross have come under fire for focusing too much money on emergency shelters and not enough attention on permanent housing. Out of frustration with endless delays in acquiring land for housing, Mobilize for Haiti, a nonprofit founded by Haitian Americans, resigned from a broad housing collaborative that included the Red Cross. The U.S. Supreme Court waded into the 2012 election when it took up a Texas redistricting case, which tests the authority of the Federal Voting Rights Act. In the fall election, Texas will add 4 new congressional districts to their delegation due to the state's increase in population. The Republican-controlled Texas state legislature approved a redistricting map that favors white Republicans at the expense of the rising population of the state's African-American and Latino communities. Minority groups and the U.S. Department of Justice took the state to court to challenge the redistricting map. As a result, a federal judge in San Antonio drew a new map more favorable to minority groups and Democrats. The state of Texas appealed the case to the Supreme Court, maintaining that the lower court had overstepped its authority by creating a new map, and sought to use the original GOP legislative map in the upcoming 2012 election. The state is seeking approval for its map from a panel of judges in Washington, D.C. By going to the Supreme Court before it completed the voting rights review of the map, civil rights groups say Texas is attempting an end run around the Voting Rights Act. Many conservative activists have challenged the legitimacy of the Voting Rights Act by claiming it no longer serves its original purpose. According to ProPublica, the Supreme Court must rule on which map to use for the 2012 congressional election, and their decision could tip the balance of which party will control the House of Representatives. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
As the U.S. and European Union ratcheted up economic sanctions against Iran for what the West believes is the Islamic Republic's covert effort to build nuclear weapons, the assassination of an Iranian nuclear scientist has escalated an already tense situation. 32-year-old Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan, a university professor who served as deputy director for commercial affairs at Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment facility, and his driver were killed January 11th in Tehran when a bomb attached to his car exploded. Witnesses said that a motorcyclist placed a magnetic bomb under the car, an explosive similar to those that have killed other Iranian scientists. This was the fifth time in 2 years that scientists working in Iran's nuclear research program have been the target of assassination. Although Secretary of State Hillary Clinton categorically denied U.S. involvement in the murder of Mr. Roshan, the Iranian government has placed blame on both Israel and the United States for recent assassinations. Iranian officials have vowed that the nation's nuclear program, that they maintain is for civilian energy production only, will move forward despite the violence. Concern that Israel may be planning airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facilities, published reports say that President Obama and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta have warned Israel against taking unilateral military action and instead allow more time for sanctions to pressure Iran. The two nations have also postponed joint missile defense exercises for the spring in order to avoid further escalating tensions with Iran. Your reporter spoke with Mohammad Sahimi, professor of chemical engineering and materials science at the University of Southern California. Sahimi, an Iranian native, expresses concern about the recent assassinations of Iranian scientists and rising tensions with the West that could lead to war.
We have had a covert war that has been going on against Iran since 2001. Those listeners of your program that are interested can go to PBS Frontline Tehran Bureau website and see my latest posting there where I chronicle the decade-old covert war against Iran since 2001, when in July 2001, a leading figure in Iran's conventional missile program was found dead in his office with a bullet in his head. Then in January 2007, a prominent Iranian nuclear scientist was killed. Then we had two other prominent nuclear scientists. One was assassinated in summer of 2010, and another one barely escaped the assassination, who is now the president of Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. Then we had another nuclear scientist assassinated just last summer, and then the latest one was this past week, Mustafa Roshan, who was also was in a senior position at Natanz uranium enrichment facility in central Iran, where the bulk of Iran enrichment activity is taking place. That has created a lot of tension in Iran and also in the West. I believe it is counterproductive because it has basically cornered the Iranian government into a position that if these assassinations and other aspects of covert war that continue, then it may compel the Iranian government to take some sort of retaliatory actions against U.S. forces in that region and Israel, which can quickly spread and become a full-fledged war, which, in my opinion, will cause the world economy to collapse, because the first thing that it will do would be to dramatically increase the oil price in the international market. Iran has already threatened that it will close the Strait of Hormuz, which connects the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, through which 20% of all the oil consumed in the world passes every day. Of course, if Iran closes the strait, the U.S. Fifth Fleet, which is in Persian Gulf, it is headquarters in Bahrain, will surely intervene to reopen the strait. And of course, Iranians, if they are really intended to keep the strait closed, will react, and that would lead to a major war between the United States and Iran. And this is a really a dangerous situation.
Professor Sahimi, it has been alleged that these assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists may have been specifically designed to provoke Iran to take military action in some way, shape, or form, which in turn could serve as a pretext for an attack on Iranian nuclear research facilities by either Israel or the United States. Do you think there is such a strategy going on here that has led to the orchestrated assassinations of these Iranian scientists?
I think this is the most plausible scenario behind the covert war, and including the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. It seems that at least one goal of this assassination is to provoke Iranians into taking some sort of retaliatory actions against U.S. And or Israel, most likely Israel, which would lead to a counterattack, and then it will compel the United States to enter the war in defense of Israel. There are other, of course, goals that are presumably pursued by such a covert war and a program of assassination, including creating a sense of insecurity among the Iranians, worsening the economic situation due to political instability, and frightening Iranian scientists from joining Iran's nuclear program, most of which I think are baseless. In fact, there has already been a backlash in Iran against such assassinations because when it comes to protecting Iran's national assets and resources, including its scientists, Iranians, regardless of where they stand in the political spectrum, are united. And in fact, that by itself is also dangerous in the sense that if Iranians are united or mostly united, then that may provide a window for the Iranian government, which is repressive, which has had bad economic policies that has led to a terrible economic situation in addition to the sanctions that have been imposed on Iranians, and also distract the people from their real goal, which is democratizing Iran and moving it in a democratic movement. So this covert war and this program of assassination have actually been totally counterproductive, because if the goal of the covert program and assassination is to slow down Iran's nuclear program, it's not going to achieve the goal, because about 30,000 people work in Iran's nuclear program, and therefore assassinating a few, even if they are top scientists, is not going to do much to slow down the program. The only way that we can reach some sort of accommodation with the Tehran regime and lower the tension and the possibility of war is to pursue diplomacy such that both nations can see the benefit of it, and therefore they can come to the negotiation table and reach some sort of compromise.
That was Mohammad Sahimi, professor of chemical engineering and materials science at the University of Southern California and lead political columnist with the PBS Frontline Tehran Bureau website. Find links to Professor Sahimi's columns and other related articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On January 13th, the officer in charge of an evidentiary hearing investigating allegations that Army Private First Class Bradley Manning leaked classified government documents to WikiLeaks determined that the 24-year-old Manning should be court-martialed on all 22 charges. Private Manning stands accused by the U.S. government of being the source of 260,000 diplomatic government cables, more than 90,000 intelligence reports, and a video of a U.S. helicopter attack in Baghdad, later distributed to the press by WikiLeaks. Among the most serious charges are aiding the enemy, a capital offense, although government prosecutors have said they will not pursue the death penalty. But if convicted on all counts, Bradley Manning could spend the rest of his life in prison. His trial is expected to begin in the next few months. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Kevin Gostola, a civil liberties blogger with Fire Dog Lake, a website that has championed Manning's cause from the beginning. Fire Dog Lake and the Bradley Manning Support Network have exposed the inhumane treatment they say Manning was subjected to at the Quantico Naval Brig that included solitary confinement and being stripped naked for extended periods of time. Here, Gostola describes the decision to move to a court-martial and the strategy of both the defense team and the government in pursuing the case.
Well, the latest news is that all of the charges that were being, I guess you would say, deliberated on, the investigative officer had to make a decision after the pretrial hearing whether or not those would be charges that went into a court-martial, he decided that all of them, and there's 23 different charges, including an aiding the enemy charge, which is a capital offense that carries the possibility of the death penalty, and those charges are all going to carry into the court-martial.
How does Bradley Manning seem? Do you know anything about his state of mind?
What I had been telling people who asked about what I thought and how he looked, he's been detained, held in detention for more than 550 days. And I said, you know, for being in detention that long, he actually looked pretty normal. It's very hard to detect that he has any sort of issues from being confined. I'm not saying that he has no problems. I'd say that he's very happy and pleased. And from his aunt, we have a bit of a note that came out around Christmas time that he was very pleased with all the support that he received during the hearing. And he wanted all of his supporters to know that, you know, he was doing well and was getting along fine.
Kevin Gustola, please just remind our listeners about the defense Manning's lawyer plans to present.
I think that their case is going to be built around, one, the mental state of Bradley while he was there. He believes that he's actually a different gender, so a woman, and has had gender identity issues, and they're going to push that angle. And they also are going to push the angle of how the place where he worked, the facility that he was doing his intelligence analyst work, they're going to push how the information security in that area was lax and how people were able to get away with downloading stuff to their computers and taking information in and out of the facility without really having too many superiors asking questions about what was being done, playing games, movies, listening to music on the drives. It's just bad information security. And then the final thing I would say is they are going to push that there hasn't been any risks to national security. But the one obstacle that he's had, and you can see that from his requests for depositions in the aftermath of the Article 32 hearing or the pretrial hearing, is he wants the original classification authorities to have to testify under oath or on the record about the harm. They've submitted unsworn statements. They assert that there's been harm, but they haven't been put under oath, and so those are just what they say. And he really wants to put these people under oath and force them to say that there's been a risk because it's not clear what that risk is.
But they probably wouldn't specify the harms because they'd say that would compromise national security like they have in other cases, no?
Well, so they would do this under classified information. So all these depositions that the lawyer David Coombs wants to do, and this is his request. And on the same day that this came out, that the 23 charges would proceed to the court-martial, David Coombs made a request for on-the-record depositions, and he wanted to get these all from individuals, and they would be classified. Testimony would be offered. So that would mean that the public would never really know what sort of information was shared with the defense. But at least he would get the evidence he needed to make his case for Bradley Manning.
Say a little more about the aiding the enemy charge, which potentially carries the death penalty, even though government lawyers have said they won't seek it.
So the aiding the enemy charge, it's just terrible that the government is going this far, and it is overreaching. And the biggest issue is that they're claiming that Bradley Manning knew that he was going to give the information to Al-Qaeda indirectly through WikiLeaks. This is what was said, actually, during the hearing. And if you think about this argument, it's a really bad one for people who like to cover national security issues, because in a sense, what they're saying is, if you put something out there that can be available to terrorists, then you could be considered somebody who deserves to be criminalized. Now, depending on your effect. So Bradley Manning has been very effective in what he has done, and it seems like aiding the enemy charge is all about making an example out of Manning. His lawyer also says it's part of trying to flip him and get him to testify against Julian Assange and other people in WikiLeaks. So this aiding the enemy charge is entirely all about intimidation, and so far there's no justification to show that he was working or operating for terrorists.
That was Kevin Gustola, a civil liberties blogger who writes for the FireDogLake.com website. Learn more about the charges against Bradley Manning by visiting our website at btlonline.org, where you can find links to support groups, news articles, analysis, and commentary about the case. On January 16th, as the nation honored the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the group United for a Fair Economy released a report titled State of the Dream 2012, The Emerging Majority. The report finds that in the year 2042, when people of color will collectively represent the majority of the U.S. population, the economic divide between racial groups will likely remain and may get considerably worse if current economic policies of the last three decades are unchanged. United for a Fair Economy's ninth annual assessment of Dr. King's dream of racial equality examines trends across a variety of indicators, including income, wealth, education, employment, health, and incarceration. If current trends continue, the report finds, black poverty will be nearly twice as high as white poverty, and the nation's Latinos will be living in poverty at more than 2.5 times that of whites. The report also presented data indicating that the estimated black family income in 2042 will be 61 cents for every dollar earned by white families, while Latinos will earn only 45 cents for every dollar made by white households. Your reporter spoke with Diedrich Muhammad, Senior Director of the NAACP's Economic Department and co-author of the State of the Dream 2012 report. He discusses the disturbing conclusions of the report and some of the recommendations made for changes in public policy that will be necessary to substantially reduce racial economic inequality.
Well, this year we decided to look at, people have talked about how increasingly the United States of America is no longer a majority white country, and that by 2042, in about 30 years, it's estimated that that we will actually reach this point where the majority of America is no longer white. So the majority of America will be minorities. And we wanted to see and highlight that if we continue the racial economic inequality that we have today, that is deeply impacting African Americans, Native Americans, and Latino Americans in particular, and we then have this percentage of the population growing over the next 30 years, how dire and challenging that'll be to the country as a whole, and how it will really greatly strengthen our racial and economic divides, making, I think, the economy of this country that, you know, historically, or at least since the 1950s, has been renowned for being a great middle-class society. I think we're going to see increasingly divided by class and race country, which I think is really counter to the narrative we hear. I think oftentimes we hear that we're past these racial problems. Up until recently, we haven't really focused on the growing economic inequality in this country, and this report hopes to highlight how race and economic inequality is putting this country in a projection that is very dangerous.
Diedrich, what are some of the trends that you found in terms of the racial divide when it comes to statistics we're seeing on income, wealth, education, employment, health, and incarceration?
Yeah, well, you're laying out all the main areas. We'll start off again with income. You know, a lot of the initial report we put out in the early 2000s, which just kind of helped highlight that between about 1968 to about 2002, something around there, that African Americans had 1968 were making about 54 cents on every dollar that white Americans were making, and by about 2002, they were only making 57 cents. And so it took that over 30-year period to bridge that racial inequality by 3 cents. And we're looking at a continuing trend of very slow bridging of income inequality between blacks and whites. And we're projecting that by 2042, African Americans will be making 61 cents on every dollar that white Americans were making. And something that kind of really caught my attention was that Latino Americans, who by then will be almost 25% of the population in 2042, will have a declining ratio of income to white Americans, and will only be having about 45 cents on every dollar that white Americans have. And if you put blacks and Latinos together in 2042, that's going to be about 40% of the population. So we can see how this can really be challenging again for the economy as a whole if you have this kind of growing weakness in terms of income for significant parts of the population. You know, and I want to point out, too, that this report, I think, has been fairly conservative because in terms of wealth, we've been looking at African Americans and Latinos having about 10% of the wealth of white Americans, but that really only looks at data pre-Great Recession. If you looked at post-Great Recession from about 2007 to 2010, which we didn't include in the report, but I think it's interesting research, you can see through 2007, 2009, you can see a great decline in wealth where African Americans and Latinos only have about 5% of the wealth of white Americans. And so in many ways, over the last 10 years, the country has been, going in the wrong direction with greater inequality. And so it's even possible that if the country keeps going in the direction it's gone in for the last 10 years, that things will be even worse in terms of racial economic inequality in 2042.
Well, Diedrich, before we close out, I just wanted to ask you if you could just mention a few of the policy alternatives that the country could follow that would squarely address rising income inequality in the country.
Well, there's many different ways, and I would recommend that people look at the report. But some of the suggestions in the report is looking at a more fair tax system. In the past, the wealthy, the most rich sectors of the economy were taxed much more heavily. And then that money was used to invest in programs for working class, middle class people. A lot of people don't understand that this country hasn't always been a middle class country, that this country really became a middle class country in the 1940s, 1950s, when there was massive federal spending, which also had a massive federal deficit, which really allowed for the majority of whites to become homeowners for the first time, for a massive increase in college attendance and college graduation from things like the GI Bill. But all those things happened when we still had a segregated America. And racial minorities were not allowed to participate in those programs in the same way, were not allowed to benefit. And so it's of no wonder that most racial minorities still haven't attained that type of strong middle-class lifestyle that white America had through investment. And so a lot of our policies is looking at ways of how we can better invest and create a new American middle class. And then we need to also more strongly regulate the wealthiest, the most elite, to make sure that they don't continue to crowd out resources for themselves at the expense of the majority of this country.
That was Diedrich Mohammed, Senior Director of the NAACP's Economic Department and co-author of the State of the Dream 2012 report. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org, where you can find links to download a copy of the report. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.